I feel I must follow my own instincts as regards my life, and am quite prepared to pay for my mistakes. I know I can only control the financial side of the future and that I can't insure against heartache, loneliness, etc. But if the worst happens, I shall have to be like the Arabs and fold my tent and steal silently away. By coincidence, Wallace's close friend from China, Constance Coolidge, Comtesse de Jumelac, had embarked on what turned into a frisky 10-year romance with the English novelist H.G. Wells. Though their love affair began at the same time as Wallace's, it could not have been more different from what was later billed as the royal romance of the century. Their steamy, sensual correspondence revolved around the themes of sex and desire, love, dreams, and food. "I wish I was in bed with you now," Wells wrote in February 1935, shortly after they met in the south of France. It was a frequent refrain, Wells declaring that the dear, close sweetness of love is my incessant need. Constance would tease him by saying that she was still in bed and would love for him to be able to creep beneath her warm sheets. The old time traveler described Constance as a sexual animal. "With so many of us, sex, having served its purpose, becomes an incurable habit. That, I think, is the case with her." Another note was explicit. "I want to be firmly between your legs, deep inside you, my lovely mistress, to touch your soft breasts." While Wallace would have been aware of her friend's amour when she saw her during her visits to Paris, she recoiled from these expressions of sexual intimacy. Wallace was more concerned about kitchen sinks than romantic dramas. Yet it was she who was at the swirling center of speculation about her erotic techniques, her jewelry collection, and her ambition to become queen. While British newspapers remained silent about the presence of Mrs. Simpson at court, European and American newspapers had undertaken no such collective omerta. According to the febrile American press, Queen Mary had been kicked out of Buckingham Palace to make room for Wallace and her entourage. Edward had shouted down Prime Minister Baldwin for daring to question his choice of bride, while Wallace had been given an extravagantly sumptuous gift in the form of Queen Alexandra's emeralds by her besotted royal beau. When she was asked about these stories 20 years later, she expressed her bafflement, describing the rumors as "venom, venom, venom." The woman who admitted to Herman Rogers that she had not slept with her first two husbands was not about to break that habit during her courtship with the king. When Wallace's journalist cousin, Newbold Noyes, himself no stranger to sexual shenanigans, spent the weekend with the king and his paramour at Fort Belvedere, he came away with a real appreciation of the emotional dynamic between the couple. He recalled that when the king entered the drawing room where they were all waiting, he fairly ran across the length of the room, obviously anxious to be near Wallace and to see her again without a glance to either side. She rose, curtsied, and said, "Good evening, sir." As Noyes later told Courtney Espiel, "Wallace was not his mistress. I'm willing to bet my money on that, and we are speaking in a strictly adult manner. I know now, looking back, that he meant to make her his wife more than a year before the abdication crisis. I think he expected to abdicate from the time his father died." The newspaper man's conclusion was based on watching the interaction between the couple, noticing the small gestures or absence thereof, which suggested a deeper intimacy. His instincts were confirmed by the king's decision to sue for libel an otherwise oleaginous tome called Coronation Commentary, which suggested that Edward and Mrs. Simpson were intimate before they eventually married. Those who knew the king well shared Noyes's view. Winston Churchill, who indulgently treated him like a second son, believed that their association was psychical rather than sexual, and certainly not sensual except incidentally. Although branded with the stigma of guilty love, no companionship could have appeared more natural, more free from impropriety or grossness. It was a theme taken up by the king's lawyer, Walter Monckton, who had known him since his Oxford days. As far as he was concerned, it was a mistake to assume that he was merely in love with her in the ordinary physical sense of the term. There was an intellectual companionship, and there is no doubt that his lonely nature found in her a spiritual companionship. Practical as ever, Wallace, who admitted that she was baffled by his adoration for her, had a more prosaic explanation for their attraction. As she later explained, "I liked the city, and he liked the country, but both of us liked flowers and gardening, and preferred having a house and home life to apartment or hotel living and a life of travel. For our vacations, I liked swimming, and he liked golf, but both of us preferred sea to the mountains." She liked bridge and plays, Edward poker and musical comedies, but both liked dancing. "All in all, we thought alike and agreed on most subjects. Our standards and values of life were the same." That said, she was still married to another man. Not for much longer. By the spring of 1936, there were four people involved in the Simpsons' marriage. Wallace, Ernest, the King, and her old school friend, Mary Raffray. It was getting a little crowded and complicated. For strict legal reasons, and afterwards for the historical record, all four combatants played their cards very close to their chests. At the time, Edward was in love with Wallace. Wallace was in love with King Edward VIII, if not with the man, certainly with the fringe benefits of dating a king, while Ernest and Mary were now lovers. The simplest solution to the predicament the quartet found themselves in was to agree to divorce and then remarry. They were, though, treading on dangerous ground. As Wallace had discovered to her cost, divorce was in those days a complex process with many legal traps for the unwary lover. One of the most common was the allegation of collusion. If it could be shown that the Simpson divorce had been agreed upon by the various parties involved, the divorce court judge would rightly conclude that there had been an illegal conspiracy to deceive. The York House dinner was highly suspect, especially as the king had promised that if Ernest divorced Wallace, he would secure her financial future for her lifetime. She confirmed in a confidential letter to Aunt Bessie that this transaction had indeed taken place. The issue of collusion was so sensitive that when the king ultimately wrote his memoir, titled A King's Story, in 1951, his lawyers George Allen and Walter Monckton suggested that a passage dealing with the Simpson divorce be deleted, lest it raise potentially embarrassing questions about the role of the king in breaking up the marriage. Allen wrote to publisher Daniel Longwell, "I suggest that readers ought not to be given smallest hint when author admitted to himself his love for lady, still less his wish for marriage. Such information invites criticism that either he was ready to break a home or divorce was collusive. It would also draw criticism on lady." The arrival of Mary Raffray as a guest of the Simpsons in March 1936 further complicated matters. Wallace soon realized that her friend was much more eager to spend time with Ernest than with her. When Wallace spent a weekend alone at the fort with the king, Ernest and Mary set off on a 3-day excursion to sites of historic interest around London, the couple spending at least one night together at a hotel in Dover. When they arrived back in London, Wallace announced that they were entertaining the king at Bryanston Court. He arrived early, and Mary was sent to entertain him while Ernest and Wallace were finishing dressing. As Mary rose from her curtsy, he asked, "How were the chalk cliffs?" An obvious reference to her tryst with Mr. Simpson at the port town. Long afterwards, she complained to a friend that nasty little king had put detectives on us. Right conclusion, wrong person. It was her friend Wallace who had hired her shadows. It was a very civilized state of affairs, the quartet spending the first weekend in April together at a house party hosted by Lord Dudley at Himley Hall. During their sojourn, the king scribbled endless love notes to Wallace. A boy loves a girl more and more and more was typical. It had become an incessant and exhausting refrain, Wallace complaining that the job of amusing kings in mourning isn't easy. What with keeping the king entertained, dealing with her own marital issues, and acting as unofficial royal hostess, Wallace, like Thelma before her, was so worn out that her nervous indigestion, which plagued her throughout her life, forced her to take prolonged bed rest. Presumably, the exquisite diamond bracelet from the Paris jewelers Van Cleef & Arpels, which he gave her that weekend, helped to keep her smiling. Sometime afterwards, Queen Mary visited Lord Dudley and insisted on a tour of the house, during which she reviewed that fateful weekend. She duly noted the proximity of the bedrooms and shared bathrooms of Wallace, the King, Ernest, and Mary with the pithy phrase, "I see. Very convenient." Not that Ernest was overly concerned. The following weekend, he organized another weekend away with Mary, driving to the remote Two Bridges Hotel on Dartmoor in the holiday county of Devon. Unfortunately for the lovebirds, it was not as remote as they thought. They had the ill fortune to be spotted by the king's lawyers, Walter Monckton and George Allen, who were themselves enjoying a weekend away from the capital. Just to tie the whole affair with a pink bow, in early April, Mary flew to Cannes, where she wrote two letters on Carlton Hotel stationery and sent them to her hosts in London. To Ernest, she wrote an affectionate love letter thanking him for his flowers. To Wallace, a bread-and-butter thank-you note. Fatally, she put them in the wrong envelopes, so that Ernest received the letter meant for his wife and vice versa. Realizing her mistake, Mary sent a frantic telegram to Wallace saying, "Do not open letter addressed to you as it is not for you." Of course, Wallace could not resist such an entreaty, and duly opened the letter she should have left sealed. She wasted no time in telling her friends about the contents, presenting herself as the innocent victim of her husband's duplicity. As her social circle were well aware of her place in the king's affections, few were convinced that this was human error rather than part of an elaborate plot. When Constance Coolidge was told by Catherine Rogers of the mix-up, she, like others, viewed the incident with a skeptical eye. In a letter to her father, she observed caustically, "She told this story to Catherine, but it sounds rather fishy to me. I wonder if the whole divorce wasn't agreed on together." By contrast, Herman, who was as close to Wallace as any man, sincerely believed that she was the innocent party in this affair, indignantly writing to his godmother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, mother of the sitting president, "As to Mrs. S.'s divorce, I realize that many people believe it was based on collusion. I can only tell you that I know there was no collusion, that king or no king, she would have fought her action, and that she had complete justice on her side. Time will undoubtedly prove the truth of this." Maybe he was being too much of a gentleman. For a woman with a fierce temper, her response to Ernest's infidelity was surprisingly muted. Where was the jealous fury who raged through the wardrobe of her Argentinian diplomat lover? Where, too, the sharp-tongued harridan who drove her first husband, Win Spencer, to drink and violence, and also terrified her present husband? As the deceived wife, she could be excused for uncorking her volcanic temper, especially as one of the culprits in this marital merry-go-round was her best friend from childhood. Instead, her reaction was bloodless, almost indifferent, suggesting a carefully orchestrated breakup. Wallace gave the impression of being resigned to her fate, accepting even of Ernest's wish that Mary still join them for meals and that she accompany them to social gatherings. "If it makes him happy, I suppose it's only fair for me to do it," she told her aunt, limiting herself to caustic comments about Mary's naked wardrobe, calling her Buttercup after a black hat trimmed with that flower which she brought from New York. As fishy as all this was, Mary's misplaced love letter and Ernest's hotel hopping helpfully removed the king from playing any public part in the collapse of the Simpson marriage. Just so the watching world got the message, the names of Ernest and Wallace Simpson appeared together in the court circular on May 28th, the couple attending a dinner at York House in the presence of Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, the Mountbattens, politician Duff Cooper and his radiant wife Lady Diana, as well as the American aviator Charles Lindbergh and his wife Anne. As the guests mingled, the king told Wallace, who had organized the table decorations, that this was his opportunity to introduce the prime minister to my future wife, a suggestion that earned an immediate rebuke from her. A few days later, on June 5th, the king summoned Ernest to the fort for a man-to-man talk about the provisional timetable for the Simpson divorce. Far from being an impartial observer, the king, obstinate, jealous, and needy, was making the running, eager to see Wallace set free. As Wallace's biographer, Michael Block, observed, nothing matters to him except their eventual union. He is therefore determined to break up the marriage of Wallace and Ernest. To that end, he is forever pressing, pleading, conspiring, cajoling. His lawyer, George Allen, had advised him that the timetable was tight. It would take 6 months from the granting of a divorce to securing a decree absolute to enable Wallace to marry again. The coronation was scheduled for May 1937, and the king wanted Wallace by his side as his wife and queen. He duly reported to Wallace, "My talk with Ernest was difficult this evening, but I must get after him now, or he won't move. It's so unsatisfactory until it's all settled, and we really are one." Once Ernest agreed to the king's plan, the atmosphere among the four grew frostier. Wallace refused to speak to Mary, and Ernest found himself excluded from most social gatherings involving the king. Mary wrote to her sister Anne, "On the outs with Wallace, but for God's sake keep that under your hat, so do not move in royal circles anymore." At the next York House dinner, Wallace appeared in the court circular as present on her own. She sat at one end of the table, while Lady Willingdon and the Duchess of York sat either side of the king. Lady Willingdon recalled his bizarre behavior, saying that for 15 minutes or so the king was entertaining, but then his attention wandered and all he could do was look at Mrs. Simpson. After a pause, he said, "Isn't she looking wonderful tonight?" Lady Willingdon agreed, but then the king continued, "She is the most wonderful-looking person, and the most wonderful person in the world." At this royal gush, Lady Willingdon touched her forehead, suggesting that he was not right in the head. The Simpsons' last public outing as a married couple was a weekend together at Blenheim Palace in June. The curtain, though, was falling on this act of the royal drama. On July 21st, the arrangements necessary for a smooth divorce were in place. Ernest and a woman called Buttercup Kennedy, clearly Mary Raffray, were witnessed eating breakfast in bed together at a hotel in Bray where they were guests. On July 23rd, Ernest received a standard legal letter accusing him of adultery. He promptly moved into the Guards Club. The divorce wheels firmly in motion. In August, Wallace joined the king on board the steam yacht Nalin for a planned cruise along the Dalmatian coast. It was a cozy guest list of old friends, including Lord and Lady Brownlow, the Duff Coopers, and Mr. and Mrs. Reliable, Herman and Catherine Rogers. If there was ever a time in her life when she needed trusted friends around her, this was it. Not only were Herman and the king enthusiastic oarsmen and swimmers, they enjoyed discussing naval history. With Herman around, Wallace could relax a little. He was the one man who had never, ever let her down. If only things had been different. She would have been Mrs. Rogers, an appellation she would have coveted at one time. No matter, Herman remained her confidant and her sounding board. As much as she liked Catherine, she was a tad too quiet and retiring for Wallace's tastes. Wallace was at heart a man's woman, and Herman was the man of her daydreams. Her feelings for him were proprietorial. She saw Herman as her prime ally and confidant, rather resenting Catherine's dominance in his life. Hers was a dog-in-a-manger affection, wanting Herman for herself alone. He was, she later confessed, the only man she had ever truly loved. Almost from the first day, Wallace needed Herman's steady reassurance. She feared that the cruise was cursed by Montague, luck, that unfortunate ability to snatch misery from the jaws of happiness. The whole party were shocked when Commander Jessel, captain of one of the accompanying duo of naval destroyers, was critically injured after being hit by a motor launch as he was taking an evening swim. Then the lifeboats on the starboard side of the Nalan were crushed to matchsticks when the yacht lurched into the rock wall of the narrow Corinth Canal that links the Gulf of Corinth to the Saronic Gulf in the Aegean Sea. Wallace needed a stiff drink from the ship's well-stocked temporary bar, which had been installed after removing the library. Socially, the group, particularly Wallace, had to navigate equally narrow waters. There was much debate on board about the decorum of the king going out bare-chested in public. A sovereign clothed only in a pair of loose-fitting shorts was not, his advisers believed, consistent with the image the king emperor should project. They threw up their hands in horror when he insisted on sitting outside at a cafe table on one of the many Greek islands they visited. They may not have appreciated his informality, but the residents did. Wallace and the king managed to create a bubble where all was love and adoration. When the peasant folk from the impoverished island of Cortula staged a torchlight procession in their honor, the king whispered to Wallace that they had done this because they believe a king is in love with you. From time to time, slivers of the outside world managed to pierce their protective carapace. When the party stopped briefly at Brdo in Yugoslavia on the outgoing journey, Princess Olga, the wife of Prince Paul of Yugoslavia, made a deliberate point of not receiving Wallace as the king's lady. Later, when the group arrived in Turkey, Queen Mary made it known that she did not approve of the king taking his mistress to the First World War battleground of Gallipoli, where so many British and Dominion soldiers had died. After the 4-week cruise, Wallace spent a few days in Paris, nursing a cold and catching up on the gossip with her friends Foxy Gwynn and Gilbert Miller. As she leafed through the shoal of newspaper cuttings which had been sent by her American friends and family, she realized that she was now the epicenter of gossip across two continents. "The Yankee at King Edward's Court," yelled one headline as the American press lasciviously charted life on board the royal love boat. London society was equally inquisitive. Wallace's shipmate, Lady Diana Cooper, endlessly, if decorously, answering the question on everyone's lips, were Wallace and the king sleeping together? "I haven't the least idea," she told her interlocutors irritably. "How should I know? Though I'm perfectly sure they did." As she lay on her fevered bed of pain in her Paris hotel room, Wallace had the first chance in months to review her options without interruption. She didn't like what she saw. In the next few weeks, she planned to divorce a man who, for all his faults, had proved a steadfast, if unexciting, companion. She was swapping steadiness and certainty for an unclear future. Pondering the possible scenarios, she could hear her mother's voice in her ear. "You are never satisfied with what you have, or what you are, or have become. Never, never, never." She realized that for the past few years, the unrealistically romantic Montague side of her had been chasing a dream. A fantasy of one day becoming the Queen of England, Empress over the biggest empire the world had ever seen. That dream was now tantalizingly close. But what price personal happiness? What price Wallace? Was she in love with the man, or the position, or both? She feared that she was selling her soul for a rainbow of promises from a man who had made similar vows to others. It was time to give her sensible Warfield personality a chance. She needed to play for time, telling the king that she was too sick to travel to Balmoral, where he was due to be in residence. In between sniffles, she sat down with pen and paper, writing and posting the royal equivalent of an "It's not you, it's me" letter, thus ending their relationship. She told him that she was amazed and shocked by the publicity that her impending divorce and friendship with the king had attracted, and wrote of her deepening misgivings regarding their future. It was her duty to go back to Ernest, if he would have her. "I am sure you and I would only create disaster together. I want you to be happy. I feel sure I can't make you so, and I honestly don't think you can me." She foresaw trouble with the Prime Minister and the government, and felt that she could not put him in a position where he was forced to relinquish his throne. To end the lie that she was a gold digger, she promised to liaise with his lawyer, George Allen, and return the money he had settled on her. It was all too little too late. The king would not accept her leaving for a solitary second. In between threats to shoot himself if she did not join him at Balmoral, he prostrated himself before her, a man worshipping at the shrine of love. "You see, I do love you so entirely, and in every way, Wallace. Madly, tenderly, adoringly, and with admiration and such confidence," he wrote. In the end, she surrendered to his entreaties, waving her fragrant white handkerchief. Before agreeing to join him at Balmoral, she insisted that Herman and Catherine accompany her on the journey north. She needed friends by her side before she entered the lion's den. As ever, nothing went quite to script. Gallantly, the king drove to Aberdeen Station to pick up his beloved and her friends. In order to do so, he cancelled his presence at the opening of a local hospital, citing court mourning. He asked his brother, the Duke of York, and his wife to do the honors in his stead. When he was photographed in his jaunty goggles, kilt, and tam-o'-shanter, standing by his open-topped tourer outside Aberdeen Station, the waves of disapproval were felt far beyond the Scottish border. Inevitably, Wallace was in the firing line. "Down with the American whore," said a slogan chalked on one wall. Inside the Highland pile, she was deliberately snubbed by the Duchess of York when she and her husband visited the king. "I have come to dine with the king," she announced as she brushed past Wallace. Not that Wallace gave the Duchess or any others at the Highland gathering any hint of her inner turmoil. During the weekend, she seemed gay and carefree, laughing and joking with Prince George and Mountbatten, giving the impression of having a high old time. Her mood was captured by Herman Rogers, who, as he had on the Nolan cruise, brought along his trusty cine camera. He filmed the king out stalking, standing on a cliff looking out over the lonely misty moor at the White Mouth, and captured the party playing an Austrian game called Arrow Golf, which Mountbatten, Prince George, and the king all tried. What is striking about Herman's 11-minute silent movie is how the moving image captures the many moods that scud across Wallace's face. For still photographs, she usually looks rather grave and subdued, the camera catching her masculine angularity. By contrast, she could be another person when the movie camera films her, her face animated, eyes alight and often amused, gestures quick and darting. She chats easily with the guests, often the center of lighthearted banter, her expression bubbling over with mirth. Photographer Cecil Beaton was struck by her staccato conversation, which was punctuated by explosive bursts of firework laughter that lit up her face with great gaiety and made her eyebrows look attractively surprised. The other enduring feature of the black-and-white reel is the easy intimacy existing between Herman and Wallace. As they walk around the Balmoral Gardens, they exude a comfortable familiarity, rather like husband and wife. An outsider watching the reel who did not know the story of Mrs. Simpson and the King would be hard-pressed to say with certainty who was Wallace's partner, Herman or the King. As Herman's second wife Lucy later recalled, Wallace was the great love of his life, but it was a purely platonic relationship. He was such a straightforward man that he would not have had it any other way, and he would never have divorced Catherine, who knew how he felt about Wallace but put up with it. But if Herman had become a widow earlier, before Wallace met the Duke, I'm sure he would have married her. In fact, he told me so. In the next few months, Herman's resolve would be sorely tested. When she left Balmoral, Wallace had a date with destiny. On October 27, 1936, her divorce was scheduled for hearing in the Suffolk town of Ipswich, 70 miles northeast of London. Known as the birthplace of King Henry VIII's right-hand man, Cardinal Wolsey, home of naval hero Lord Nelson, and a setting for Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers, the market town was soon to earn worldwide recognition as the location for a divorce which would ultimately change the course of royal history. Not that the British public were going to hear about this dramatic turn of events anytime soon. Thanks to a compact between the bullet-headed press baron, Lord Beaverbrook, and the King, the British press kept a gentlemanly silence. Edward argued successfully that it was unfair to publicize Wallace's private affairs simply because she was a friend of the King. Her unwanted notoriety was making her ill and distressed. The American and European press would have none of it, charting every moment of Wallace's life. Whenever she left her new home on Cumberland Terrace in Regent's Park, the King paid the $160 a week rent for 8 months and installed a private telephone line to Buckingham Palace. She was photographed and followed. When the King was spotted waiting patiently for Wallace when she went to the hairdresser's, it made scandalous headlines everywhere except Britain. Wallace found the attention wearing. It became such a strain that the King asked the Metropolitan Police Commissioner if patrols around her rented home could be beefed up. He duly obliged. With such day-to-day scrutiny, it was something of a relief when in early October she traveled to Felixstowe, an unremarkable coastal town near Ipswich, where she stayed for several weeks before the hearing in order to establish residency. She traveled in the King's Buick, driven by George Ladbroke, the King's chauffeur, and was represented by the King's lawyer. Naturally, all expenses and fees were paid by the King. On October 27th, after a 19-minute court hearing, Justice Hawke duly granted the decree nisi with costs after hearing of Ernest's adultery with a certain Buttercup Kennedy. When she arrived back at her rented house in Regent's Park, Wallace, punch-drunk and brooding about her future, received a welcome letter from the man who had been her knight in shining armor, a man who solved problems rather than generated them. Their relationship, already close and steadfast, would become even more intimate in the coming weeks. Herman Rogers, who was not prone to hyperbole in his correspondence, was, for him, recklessly affectionate towards her. He wrote, "I can't tell you how sorry we are that you should have to go through this dismal time. I wish you had asked us to stay around, or to come back if we could have been of any help to you. You know we'd have been only too glad to. That goes for the future as well, and please remember it if you ever need us. You are still my one living example of a perfectly wise and complete person. We are with you always. Come to us if and when you can, or call us if you want to." Her call for help was not long coming. Chapter 11. You Goddamned Fool. The plot was simple but audacious: to blow up King James I and his Protestant Parliament and strike a blow for the Roman Catholic faith. Fortunately, the King got wind of the conspiracy and, after a search of the Houses of Parliament on November 5, 1605, barrels of gunpowder were discovered along with a man named Guy Fawkes, who was holding a slow fuse. He and his fellow conspirators were arrested, tortured, and then hanged, their bodies cut into quarters and dragged through the streets of London. Every November 5th, in celebration of the thwarting of the gunpowder plot, bonfires are lit, effigies of Guy Fawkes are burned, and fireworks exploded. On Bonfire Night 1936, the king's friend Charles Wynne, a member of the Yorkshire family who owned Nostell Priory, attended a friend's firework party with a number of fellow aristocrats. High on the bonfire, a straw effigy was well alight. "I see you have Guy Fawkes up there," he remarked to his host. "Oh, no," said his friend. "That's Wallace Simpson," he continued, laughing. "Now, an unmarried man needs a girl now and again. But marrying her? Can you believe it?" While the British public remained in the dark about the existence of the now twice-divorced American, Wynne's experience that night demonstrated that the flames of publicity were crackling ever nearer. Among the widening circle of those in the know, events were moving apace. The ashes from the nation's bonfires were still smoldering as members of Parliament were gripped by open talk of either an abdication or Wallace's replacement by an eligible European princess. Guests at a dinner party hosted by Lady Colfax were consumed by rumors that the king intended to make Wallace the Duchess of Edinburgh and marry her. Diarist and MP Harold Nicholson observed, "The point is whether he is so infatuated as to insist on her becoming queen, or whether the marriage will be purely morganatic." A gaggle of aristocrats cornered the American ambassador at one soiree and warned him that the situation was grave and the monarchy in danger. Amidst this hysterical speculation, Emerald Cunard nursed the delicious possibility of being the power behind the throne after a rather tipsy Leslie Hoare Belisha, Minister for Transport, told her that Edward was to marry Wallace in the chapel at Windsor Castle, and that a new pro-king government would be in power within weeks. The gathering conflagration centered around exactly whom the king could marry. Under the Royal Marriages Act, he could choose anyone he wished, apart from a Roman Catholic. As Wallace was Presbyterian, she passed that test. Where the conflict arose was not because she was American. Wealthy American girls had been keeping the British aristocracy financially afloat for a century, but because she was twice divorced, with two husbands still living. This directly contradicted the teachings of the Church of England, which the king, as defender of the faith, vowed to maintain. Archbishop Cosmo Lang wrestled with the heavy burden he felt at possibly consecrating Edward as king. If he went ahead and married Mrs. Simpson, it would shake the foundations of the church's influence and teaching. Not only did Edward have to hurdle objections from the church, he faced opposition from the dominions, parliament, and the cabinet. Early on, Stanley Bruce, the Australian High Commissioner and former Prime Minister, laid down the gauntlet, saying that his country would leave the empire should Wallace marry the king. A clash between king and parliament would create an explosion that even Guy Fawkes would have been proud of. King versus country. It was a recipe for a constitutional crisis. From the beginning, the king seemed to have no conception of the forces ranged against him, and even if he did, stubborn as he was sure he could find a loophole. After all, didn't his charm, his popularity among the people, and his lifelong service to the empire count for anything? On this occasion, the answer was nope. He believed, wrongly, that his popularity as king translated into personal popularity. On such an intimate matter as his choice of bride, he felt that John Bull would rally behind him. Wallace, knowing little if anything of the British Constitution, believed it too, arguing that a radio broadcast to his loyal subjects would swing the tide in his favor. Baldwin shut that door pretty sharpish, informing the king that he could not make a broadcast without the consent of his ministers, and consent would not be forthcoming. Feeling trapped and helpless, Wallace even consulted her own advisor, former American actress, now celebrity astrologer, Nella Webb, at her London home. Her prophecy was not too wide of the mark, the seer telling Wallace, "The opposition to you cannot be sidestepped. It will have to be faced or managed. You may be able to rise above it. The bonds of love will be made secure and fast. A marriage could occur sometime next year, in August or September." Besides consulting her astrologer, Wallace's other contribution was to suggest that Edward hire a New York public relations whiz kid to present the king's case to the world. Within days, she needed no crystal ball or PR handout to tell her that the opposition was already at hand. On November 13th, the phony war ended when the king's private secretary, Alex Hardinge, sent a letter alerting him to the fact that within the next few days the press were likely to go public regarding his friendship with Mrs. Simpson. Furthermore, should he insist on marriage to the American divorcee, the government would resign and a general election would be called. His advice was that Mrs. Simpson should go abroad without delay. As obstinate as he was foolhardy, the king was adamant that she should stay, and told her during a tense evening conversation at the fort that if the country would not approve of them marrying, he would go. On November 16th, he repeated this threat to Baldwin. That same day, he went to Marlborough House for dinner with his mother, Queen Mary, and sister, Mary. They were shocked and disbelieving when he said he was prepared to give up the throne for Wallace. While his mother retained her dignity and composure, she later gave vent to the sense of betrayal she and the royal family felt regarding his utterly selfish behavior. "I do not think you have ever realized the shock which the attitude you took up caused your family and the whole nation. It seemed inconceivable to those who had made sacrifices during the war that you, as their king, refused a lesser sacrifice." It was not long before he had similar audiences with his three brothers, who took the news with varying degrees of shock and anger. Bertie, the stuttering, somewhat slow Duke of York, and now King-in-Waiting, was utterly devastated while, according to Lady Furness, the Duke of Gloucester slapped his elder brother across the face. All the while, the king undertook his duties impeccably, opening Parliament, inspecting the home fleet, and, more contentiously, visiting the impoverished mining towns of South Wales, where he uttered the phrase that would define his brief reign, "Something must be done," in relation to the near starvation and unemployment suffered by so many families. As the king walked past the hollow-eyed, hopeless parents and their ragged urchins, Wallace was dining at Claridge's with newspaper proprietor Esmond Harmsworth, who suggested morganatic marriage as a way out of the impasse. Unheard of in Britain but common on the continent, especially in German royal houses, it was a form of marriage where the commoner, in this case Wallace, did not take the royal husband's rank or title upon marriage. It would, though, require special legislation. The king was distinctly cool, a strange, almost inhuman concept, he thought. Prime Minister Baldwin promised to ask the 11 dominions their view. He was not hopeful. Meanwhile, the new sovereign was being counseled by, among others, Churchill, Beaverbrook, Monckton, and Duff Cooper to be patient, to go through with the coronation, introduce Wallace to the world gradually, and then marry whom he pleased when he was firmly established as sovereign. It was only the king's impatience that had created a constitutional crisis in the first place. Whether he stayed or abdicated, he would have to wait 6 months, until April 27, before Wallace was officially divorced and could remarry. During that time, he had ample opportunity to save the throne and his bride. Propelled by furious angels, He had turned a moral issue into an unnecessary constitutional and political tug of war between himself and the Prime Minister, a battle he was bound to lose. As Wallace's friend Elsa Maxwell noted, she might have been Queen of England had they been better intriguers, had they kept very quiet and she out of England. When he had been crowned, he could have married her and asked no one's permission. Churchill and Beaverbrook felt it imperative that Cutie, their nickname for Wallace, leave the country. The king disagreed. The impish Beaverbrook took it upon himself to encourage a journalist from his newspaper, the Daily Express, to throw stones at her rented house in Regent's Park. The tactic worked, a flurried Wallace hurrying to the fort for safety, Aunt Bessie in tow. She was not there for long. On Thursday, December 3, 1936, the long-predicted storm broke. Every British newspaper filled with stories about the royal friendship or, as H.L. Mencken, the sardonic sage of Wallace's Baltimore, put it, "the greatest news story since the resurrection." Under the banner headline, "Grave Crisis," the August Times of London laid out the establishment case. In a leader, it noted that an American wife for the king would be a not unwelcome innovation for the House of Windsor. Then came the but. The one objection, and it is an overwhelming objection, is that the lady in question has already two former husbands living from whom in succession she has obtained a divorce. This was the settled consensus, so much so that American Ambassador Robert Bingham was impressed enough by a beautifully conceived and expressed article in The Liberal Observer by editor J.L. Garvin to write a warm letter of congratulation. While his opinion piece, penned in December 1936, praised the goodwill and good judgment of the empire during the abdication crisis, the king and Wallace were minded to ignore the message, believing that it was the result of an establishment plot to drive him off the throne. As he leaped through the morning's newspapers, Wallace's picture on every front page, the king gallantly but reluctantly agreed for Wallace to head overseas so that she did not have to see or hear what was being said about her. Though he was primarily concerned about her health, she had been confined to bed for a week's rest. It was a catastrophic mistake, one Wallace regretted for the rest of her life. At a critical time when every decision led to an inevitable and irreversible conclusion, Wallace needed to be on hand as a trusted sounding board to discuss grave matters regarding her future and that of the monarchy. She may not have known much about the British Constitution, but she had practical common sense and knew how to change the obstinate king's mind. On that fateful day, she had one idea in mind, to get out of Dodge and save her own skin. There was no thought of standing by her man in his hour of peril. "I was hurt deeply, and I was desperate. I said I had to leave as my position had become impossible," she later recalled. She contacted Herman Rogers, the one man in the world she could rely on, and took him up on his offer to stay with them. After a fluster of packing, she made a hurried late-night exit from the fort, heading for the place she considered her second home, Louviers, in the south of France, where she had spent so many weeks on holiday. Here, at least, she would be among trusted, loving friends. The decision may have soothed Wallace's jangled nerves, but it did little to advance her cause to become queen. As Beaverbrook noted of the king and his desire to protect Wallace, his anxiety was intense, but he was anxious about the wrong things. All his energies should have been devoted to the main issue, which was the struggle to remain on the throne and to marry in due time. It was a doleful parting for the couple on that dank evening of December 3, 1936. As they kissed goodbye, neither knew when or where they would meet again. Wallace left him her dog, Slipper, the first significant present he ever bought her, for company. "I don't know how it's all going to end," he told her. "It will be some time before we can be together again. You must wait for me no matter how long it takes. I shall never give you up." Besides a Scotland Yard detective, her companion for the journey was Lord Perry Brownlow, the king's trusted friend and lord-in-waiting. Unknown to his master, Brownlow was involved in a benign conspiracy among the king's supporters to encourage Wallace to renounce the marriage outright and thus avoid the king's abdication. Essentially, it was a further variation on Beaverbrook and Churchill's playing for time argument. They had barely left the fort when Brownlow ordered the car to stop and strongly suggested that she stay at his country estate in Lincolnshire, arguing that from there she could more easily influence the king and prevent him from making drastic decisions in the heat of the moment. She was tempted, but decided to stick to the plan. She did not want to be blamed if the strategy went wrong, and she wanted to get as far away from this cursed isle as she could. "Today I am in the pillory. Tomorrow I will be in the Tower of London," she said, somewhat histrionically. It was a fatal mistake. From the moment they reached Dieppe, they were playing catch-up, never once at the pitch of discussions in London. Within minutes of landing in France, they were spotted, and the hunt was on. For the next 2 days, Wallace endured a nightmare journey of fog, snow, ice, route changes, car chases, near collisions, and escapes from the clutches of the press by climbing through bathroom windows. At roadside inns, she made desperate attempts to call the king on crackling phone lines where her words were barely intelligible, if heard at all. It was, she later recalled, like a nightmare in which one dreamt that one's living soul was suddenly confronted by the corpse from which it had taken leave. In the early hours of December 5th, Wallace, crouching in the back of the car with a blanket over her like a fugitive from justice, was driven through the iron gates of Louviers. Her new home, high on the hills above Cannes, was a former monastery that had been ransacked by Saracens during the 8th century. It was named Louviers, or Old One, after the ghost of one of the murdered monks who still roamed the house. That night, even Herman, who claimed to see the ghost 4 or 5 times a week, was shocked by the apparition before him. Wallace looked like a wraith, drip white, exhausted and crumpled, a world away from the figure of neat perfection she normally presented to the world. Catherine gave her a hug of welcome and ushered her inside where a log fire was blazing. She awoke late, not to the sound of birdsong, but chatter from the vicinity of the garden gates where the world's media, described by Wallace as a ravenous, besieging army, were camped. Her first mistake was to open the bedroom windows to admire the view over the seaside resort. The next day, the picture of her in her pink nightgown appeared on front pages around the world. She would not make that mistake again. It was a salutary reminder that she was a prisoner, as surely as if she had been convicted and sent to Alcatraz. Wallace, unable to go out into the garden to admire Herman's planting, or enjoy the sublime view over the Mediterranean without being photographed. Catherine told her to keep her curtains closed, as several cameramen had climbed nearby trees and had their long lenses focused on her bedroom. Restful it wasn't, the confines of the modest villa further compressing jangling nerves. After lunch, she sat down and wrote a somewhat incoherent 15-page letter to the king, which she sent by airmail in the hope it would reach him before he had taken any irrevocable step. As ever, she urged him not to abdicate, and to delay any decision until late the following year, as Beaverbrook and others consistently advised. By the time the letter reached the king, the die was cast. Meanwhile, Wallace was under siege from without and betrayed from within. Her Scotland Yard detail were more of a nuisance than a help. Herman had one detective sent home after discovering he was leaking information to eager newsmen. Then the remaining officers telegrammed a report to London suggesting that Wallace was about to flee to Germany because she was frit, vernacular for frightened. This merely added to the hysterical opinion that she was in the pay of the Nazi high command, Ambassador von Ribbentrop, both her controller and her lover. Local telephone operators were bribed to listen into phone calls. Herman's butler was offered 10,000 French francs, $600, to allow a newsman to dress as one of the workmen who were installing a new bathroom, and even Herman himself was offered nearly 1 million francs, $60,000, for his home movies of Wallace's visit to Balmoral and the Nolan cruise. While Herman turned the offer down out of hand, he did agree to parley with the waiting press, giving daily briefings of a purely factual nature about events in the villa. His straight-talking and truthful manner earned the respect of the hard-boiled news corps. After the crisis was over, the gentlemen of the press all signed a letter of thanks for his efforts on their behalf. Media were one thing, madmen quite another. Wallace had given Herman the task of weeding out the hate mail from the growing pile of letters she received daily. Among the letters in the crackpot file was a worrying series of threatening missives written by a seemingly well-educated Australian who had posted his threats from several London postal districts. He made it clear that he was traveling to France to find Wallace and put a bullet in her. Herman said nothing to Wallace, who was already in a state of high anxiety. But he quietly alerted Inspector Evans, in charge of the Scotland Yard detail, who passed the warning on to London. For the next few months, Herman slept in a bedroom adjoining Wallace's, a loaded pistol by his bedside. Amidst this sinister cacophony, Wallace tried to speak to the king. It was a losing battle. What with dropped connections, intense static and echo, Wallace felt like she was speaking from another planet, let alone another country. What Herman remembered from that fevered period was the sound of Wallace shouting down the telephone, "Do not abdicate! Do nothing reckless! Listen to your friends!" It was an increasingly hopeless cause. Though she was the cause and possible resolution of the drama, Wallace was now relegated to the role of onlooker as events in London moved to their inevitable climax. The king was resolutely sailing his ship of state alone, implacable in his solitary resolve. He was past counsel, past argument, past pleading. For Wallace, it was like talking to a stranger. The king was remote and unreachable. She had pleaded with him. Abdication would be disastrous for you and destroy me. He was deaf to all entreaties. Terrified of becoming, as she described, the blackest woman in history, she decided to take the initiative herself. After discussions with Herman and Perry Brownlow, she settled on a strategy to prevent the abdication. First, she would release a statement saying that she would give him up. Then she would head for either Genoa or Brindisi in Italy and catch a liner bound for China. Her detective, Evans, was sent to reconnoiter. She needed to make the king understand that the price of marriage was not only damage to the crown, but, as she said, the destruction of my peace of mind, my reputation, and my self-respect. However, her announcement, which the king greeted at first with shock and then reluctant agreement, fell short of a public disavowal, which by now was the only trick left in the game. Her statement proclaimed her innocence but failed to say that she would withdraw from his life forever. It read, "Mrs. Simpson, throughout the last few weeks, has invariably wished to avoid any action or proposal which would hurt or damage His Majesty or the throne. Today her attitude is unchanged, and she is willing, if such action would solve the problem, to withdraw forthwith from a situation that has been rendered both unhappy and untenable." Brownlow and Herman drove to the Majestic Hotel in Cannes, where Brownlow read it to the assembled throng. Much as Wallace wanted the statement to dilute the animosity towards her, the London newspapers saw it as a sign that the crisis was past and Edward would remain on the throne. As Churchill, Beaverbrook, and others mulled over the mood music, from Cannes came the most extraordinary twist in this drama. Out of the